startup mom, single mom, but, and it was never 50-50. Unfortunately, I was in a situation where I was doing all of the work and it wasn't working for me. No matter where you're from, no matter who you are, you can build something, you have a story to tell, you can help other people.
Hey folks, this is Hong from FunBMC. Welcome back. This is episode 4, and my guest today is actually, I like to call her a personal friend of mine, even though we've recently met or recently started working together. Known for a long time. Leanne Johnson, welcome.
Thank you so much, Hong. Happy to be here.
I would say founder of Phoenix Creative, which is a agency in San Jose. And fun fact, we used Leanne's services for our last Kickstarter campaign. So I think did an amazing job. We had a super cool video. You may have seen it, the Karmic Oslo. Leanne also has a few other things in common with me besides the term Phoenix or the name Phoenix. She's Yale 2001, a history major, which is rare here in the Valley. Worked as a Heritage Foundation research writer for a while, but then became an educator for 14 years. And then in 2008, she started Phoenix. How far back do you want to go? Do you want to talk about Yale? Do you want to talk about
anything you
education?
Want? Sure. And I'm up for anything.
Let's talk about Yale. Okay. How did you end up there?
Well, I wanted to make my parents proud and please them. And so went, got good grades, went to Yale, became a history major. And then, like you said, I ended up at the Heritage Foundation. I actually started off as their educational coordinator and ran their intern program. And then I was quickly swiped up to the president's office, where I was his research assistant, wrote his speeches, wrote articles, mostly on things like economic policy, educational policy. But I worked there for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And then stopped because I was starting a family.
Yeah. So after the Heritage Foundation, you said you stopped because you started a family?
I started a family, yep.
So
I got married when I was 23. Okay. Had my first daughter when I was 25. And when I was dating, he was a Yale alumnus, 11 years older than I am. And he was working at the Department of Education and I was still a student at Yale. And he asked me what I thought of homeschooling. Mm. And honestly, I thought it was kind of a little funny. I thought it was strange, but which is most people's initial impression of it in the 80s and 90s, because it wasn't all that common. But I had a very open mind. I was like, I'm not sure. I would love to read about it and learn more. Because at least like one fault I noticed with my own education was, like I alluded to earlier, was the learning burn. Learning for the tests, getting exhausted, learning the system, but not really learning for mastery or the love of learning, which I really tried to do in college. I would take classes that I wanted to take and learn for the sake of learning and not necessarily learn to just check off a box.
Yeah.
And so I thought, wow, if I have the opportunity to provide my kids with an education that caters to their learning styles, but also like can contribute to their love of learning, I really want to do that. And so we decided that when we had kids, we would homeschool them together 50-50 assess it sort of annually, and as long as we could provide a better education to the kids than what was available to us, then we would homeschool them. And it's kind of like every parent makes this decision, like, what do I want to outsource for my child? Like, I am the manager, like I'm their parent, I'm their manager. I'm going to, like, maybe I'll outsource music lessons. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm going to outsource education. Maybe I'm going to outsource X, Y, and Z. And so it's sort of the question that you ask when you're parenting a kid. And so I homeschooled my three kids from the beginning for 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And so,
but this is early. Homeschooling is still a very like.
Yeah. Well, I learned then that there were more people doing it than I realized, and it was growing very quickly.
Yeah.
And now, so I've homeschooled in Washington, D.C., New York City, and San Francisco, and helped to build many independent learning communities, And so the stereotype, maybe it was more like apropos for the 60s and 70s, but certainly by the mid 2000s when I was homeschooling, mm-hmm. there were just very active homeschooling communities and lots of people, like mm-hmm. single moms, two income working families, mm-hmm. Homeschooling their kids. And you can do anything from buy like boxed curriculum. You could get the curriculum from the state that you live in, to parents who write their own curriculum, to parents who unschool. Mm-hmm. And people homeschool for so many different reasons, and you can't assume to know.
What's trivium?
The trivium.
Yeah.
It is a method of learning whereby it follows the three stages of learning for children. So the three stages are the grammar stage, the dialectic stage, and the rhetoric stage. And it was developed by ancient Rome and ancient Greece, and it roughly correlates to our elementary, middle, and high school schools. And the idea is that the grammar stage, when children are in the grammar stage of learning, they're basically like sponges. They want to absorb information. That's the best time for them to learn about the like names, dates, the who, what, where,
yeah.
all the physical stuff, biology, numbers, shapes, things like that. That's elementary school. And that's why like kids have such great memories of it. They're like in elementary school, they can remember like all like taxonomic clades of dinosaurs or the yeah. names of all their different Hot Wheel cars, and because they're just absorbers of information. It's very easy for them to remember. At that time, I had my kids memorize a timeline with over 166 points and with names and dates, and they could do it pretty easily, and I still can't do it.
Yeah.
And then you have the dialectic stage, which is sort of the how and why, like how those names and dates, when you put them together, how does something happen? Why did it happen? And it's connecting more of the timeline. That's the dialectic stage. And then the rhetoric stage is the so what. Now that I know all of this information, how to apply it to me, to the society I live in? Why do we learn about the Second World War, and how is that relevant today? Is it relevant today? Mm-hmm. That's the trivium. Okay. Yeah, and not it's a classical, so I used a classical method of homeschooling, mm-hmm. but I would call it classical eclectic, because for like the younger ages, I definitely use sort of a Montessori approach, Emilio Regia approach. Yeah, very hands-on, was on the floor with my kids a lot. We just did stuff. Younger kids tend to be very kinetic learners. They love to move around, and mine are no exception, though there are a lot of exceptions, which is why people choose different curricula for their kids. And then we did classical, but then I taught grammar, writing, and mental math to fourth or third through sixth graders for a long time. That's the middle stage of learning, but I forget where I was going with that thought, but that's the dialectic stage.
It's okay. I feel like we laid the foundation for the first stage.
Yeah.
So the second stage of this is when you started Phoenix.
Yes.
Because in a way, it's sort of a starting over, right?
Yes. So Phoenix, like, which I don't know, you haven't mentioned yet, but your name means phoenix in Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Mine means lotus blossom. Metaphysical concepts there.
We're talking about spirit animals, I think.
Yeah.
My spirit animals is phoenix, obviously, but yours is?
Phoenix, lotus blossom. Yeah. Okay. Lotus blossom is the meaning of my name, but I identify a lot with the phoenix, and my partner and I, he suggested Phoenix for the name of our company. But it's sort of a rebirth and a starting over. And I'll talk to you about why I did that and how we chose the name. So like I said, I was homeschooling, and it was never 50-50. Unfortunately, I was in a situation where I was doing all of the work and it wasn't working for me. And it wasn't working for the family. So, I guess it was about, I separated from my children's father about 5 years ago. And my children are now, they're in their second year of public school. They made a pretty seamless transition to the schools in San Jose, which has been great. So I have one in elementary school, one in middle school, and one in high school. Yeah, so it's a lot of driving and coordinating rides for the kids right now. And I do 90% of the parenting and the working out of all of that. And then I started Phoenix with Jamie Bauman. And he's been in video production for 20 years, and I've been in communication for 20 years and writing. And we wanted to create a creative agency that, even though we both have worked in creative fields and in communications for a long time, but one that was really mission-based and founded on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so that all of the projects that we agree to do are at least 50% women and underrepresented minorities working on each project. But we also make sure that the projects that we do are good for the community and good for the people that we're working with. So like that was really important to us, like, because the world doesn't need necessarily more creative agencies, is there, or more businesses in general. We just need more responsible ones. And so we really wanted to make it our mission to create a company that was good for the community.
Yeah. So most agencies, I would say, are profit-driven, just the nature of the business. And like their job is to help these companies tell their stories.
Sure.
I feel lucky that we were able to, you know, work together. Because when I started Karmic, we had these ideals. And it's been really hard to stick to them. And one is this, you know, idea of using at least 50% of your team female. And we're still working on that. But it's from day one, we wanted to do that. And it's not because today, like, diversity and inclusion is kind of a hot topic and everybody wants this veneer of it. Right. But I think it's really important, like, to the core of who we are.
Yes. Well, it's the core of who you are, and also helps your company reach more people too. Mm-hmm. Sort of that natural empathy of having it built into the bones, into the foundation of your company, being able to reach out to the entire population very authentically. Mm-hmm. But also, it's just like, it's kind of the right way to do things. So it's moving in the right direction. Like, it only when people are seeing that everything needs to be 50-50 are we going to realize sort of equal pay? Are we going to realize other ideals like family leave? So paternity leave, maternity leave, that doesn't just fall on the shoulders of the mother, right? That things are, there's equal responsibility on both sides, not just for the physical needs of family, but the emotional burden as well.
Mm. Yeah. So equal parenting, you know, for a fact, you know, in our family, a lot of the emotional labor falls on my wife.
Yeah, most families.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And equal parenting doesn't necessarily mean like every single item is split 50-50, because there are days and weeks and months where that doesn't work. But it's the burden is spread out, and certainly the emotional burden is a huge one that's I think that we just didn't have the vocabulary for so long that people are talking about now, and it's really important. And I think that CEOs, founders, managers, anyone in a position of power to initiate those conversations, they should have a responsibility to do that, because it's important. And if you're thinking that your female women employees are seem distracted, like maybe they are, allow them to bring their whole selves to work and talk about that, because that's something that they bring to work, and sort of accept and work with that. And we need to change society's ideas about whose job it is to bear the burden of raising the next generation.
Yeah. I guess what differentiates your process from other creative agencies who may be a little bit more straightforward, like as a startup, I'm going to an agency and say, I need a video or a launch video or a product video. How do you think about it versus like what a typical process would be?
Like a lot of agencies, first I'll really try to understand what the problem is. Like, after that initial setup, But then I have a really large network of reaching out to not just women, but all sorts of underrepresented minorities, whether they be like people on the spectrum, people with disabilities, different people of color. And I have made it my mission to sort of really try to get out there and network with it as much as possible. Having access to a bunch of different pipelines and being able to cultivate a crew and really curate a crew rather than just falling back on the same people over and over. Like I certainly have a few of the same people I work with time and again, but really catering each project to my clients' needs.
Yeah.
And I learn about different organizations and different pipelines for different types of workers, so that I bring all of that to the table. But then as the producer, I work with my client and my crew to really make sure that all the communication is dialed in. Everyone's like, 'cause that is huge, right? Making sure that everyone understands what is going on. What's the timeline? What are the potential snagging points, friction points, and just working with everyone to make sure that the process goes really, really smoothly. And then just take it upon myself to just manage all of the juggling balls.
Yeah.
One of the things behind Phoenix is people, bringing in a diversity of people and bringing your full self to work. And part of that thread is like, I just love people. We tell stories about people. We tell stories about things, we tell stories about products, and we want to reach people with our stories and connect with people with our stories. And so it's not just telling the story of the thing that we want to tell the story, but it's connecting with the stories. People need to be able to identify with the story that you're telling, a piece of them, and it's making all of those connections. I just love people.
Yeah.
I want to help people. I want to be a better person.
I will say the two things that you pushed me to do is like, one, actually, the idea for this podcast started from a lot of conversations we had in the car, or I would say in the minivan,
because
you were production mom.
Swagger wagon.
And like, this is super uncomfortable for me to be in front of camera. I don't like to do it at all.
I think it's important. Being on the other side of the camera. It is important.
I think it's really important. That's the reason that we're doing it. And that's why I'm like kind of pushing myself, or you're pushing me. It's really your fault to tell these stories.
I'll take
because
credit.
There's not enough of these stories.
Right. Well, I think especially of, and I'll say it because you probably won't, that someone who has traveled a great distance, right? Someone who, a refugee immigrant Han, who was born in Vietnam to parents who were fleeing the country and postponed it a few years. It was still very dangerous to come here, and then grew up facing great economic hardship and social hardship. And like, even like nowadays, like we both as minorities, like I'm biracial and you're Vietnamese, like we both have experience like this outsider thing, like what are you, where are you from, go back to where you came, all of this stuff. We need to have we need a model that no matter where you're from, no matter who you are, you can build something, you have a story to tell, you can help other people, and we need to do it. And so it's not just like very stereotypical podcasts and things out there. Like, it's open to everyone. And I think as a refugee immigrant, you have a very important role to play in this conversation.
I think that's another episode.
Sure.
Yeah, a friend of mine, she's like, well, the world does not need another podcast. But I was like, just give it a chance. Wait until you see what we put out. Because we are not telling the typical story is behind what we're doing. But I think to your point, the story has been consistent, even for me, through the last 20 years. It's about helping people. It's about getting the best out of folks, giving them opportunities. Like, recruiting is not typically a role that you kind of look up to. Mm-hmm. It's like HR. People usually think it's part of HR. It's not part of HR. It's really about giving people opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And and sharing your story and sharing my story eventually. Maybe there's a kid out there who thinks I should be doing something or I can do something, and everybody around them is telling them they can't.
Right. Mm-hmm. When they see something, they see part of their story in you.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Lynn, okay. Thank you very much.
This is episode four.
Fun BMC.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. Yeah. Okay. 30. Hello, Fun BMC. This is Hong Kwan.
You should have her do it.